From South Carolina to California, New York to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, federal regulators are threatening the timber industry in Alaska. Kathy Hoekstra of the Pacific Legal Foundation has an American Heroes interview with Sarah Dahlstrom of Viking Lumber. Republicans have posted a solid victory in a hotly contested special congressional election in Tennessee. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The unfortunate death of one cat threatens to derail the use of driverless vehicles in San Francisco. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Stephen Greenhut of the R Street Institute. And more states are doing away with their personal income tax. Their populations are growing. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A generations-old timber company operating in rural Alaska is now fighting federal regulators in a battle for survival. Kathy Hoekstra of the Pacific Legal Foundation focuses the American Hero Spotlight on Sarah Dahlstrom of Viking Lumber. Kathy?
Specialized wood from Alaska's vast Tongass National Forest has shaped the sound of Steinway pianos, Martin guitars, NASA wind tunnels, helicopter blades, and so much more, supplied in large part by one family timber company and its dedicated longtime employees. But now a broken promise from Washington bureaucrats threatens to silence the saws, shutter the last mill standing, and erase a legacy as well as livelihoods, all built on the grit and sacrifice of this family and others. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Journal. And today, I'm proud to be joined by Sarah Dahlstrom, timber family daughter, advocate, and an American hero. That is a PLF client fighting for the future of Alaska's timber industry and all who depend on it. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, your dad moved your family from the lower 48 to Alaska, sight unseen, in 1994 to take over a bankrupt sawmill. Now Viking Lumber was born 6 months later. I'd love for you to share what this entire experience has meant for your family to be a part of this, what I would consider a very unique American story.
Absolutely. Yeah. So about 50 years ago, my dad and his brother and a cousin decided to build a sawmill from the ground up in Washington State. And then they got really impacted by the spotted owl in Pacific Northwest. So in 1994, they found this bankrupt sawmill where they could still supply their customers the hemlock that they needed. So they moved us up in 1994, like you said, sight unseen, to a remote island called Prince of Wales. We went to school there. We built the sawmill. We were all involved somehow with this sawmill. And today it is the, like you said, it creates the sound in the Steinway piano. It is employing rural residents in an area that doesn't have as many opportunities that we could offer in other places.
The timber industry writ large has been very subject to constant threats by environmental activism, often backed by government since at least the early 1990s. Now, though, it's the United States Forest Service reneging, actually, on a 2016 promise regarding the harvest of old growth trees. Can you briefly explain what this whole issue is all about and the government's about face?
Sure. So when the special interest groups really caught on to the spotted owl, then the Forest Service jumped on it, and so did the Clinton administration. And the same thing is happening now in Alaska. These anti-logging environmental groups are really infiltrating the Forest Service and trying to say, this is a bad thing to do, that to cut these trees down and make these products, when really a forest needs to have some harvest on it. We are a small scale harvest, and I must repeat that. It is very minimal of how much Viking harvests per year. So it would take us about 160 years to harvest 1%, like you said, of the vast Tongass National Forest, and it's going to regenerate. So we are a very small industry now. In fact, the timber industry in Southeast Alaska is about 5% of what it once was when we moved up there in the 90s, only 5%. And however, it creates these jobs. Most of our employees have been there for over 20 years. It's a great life. Many of them are building homes, they're buying houses, they're buying boats. They have a great economic opportunity on that island, getting year-round family wage jobs. It's really an impressive thing. It's not just our 50 jobs at our sawmill that we're concerned about. It's all the other jobs that Steinway in New York has 200 union employees that they're concerned about. If they don't receive a supply of their Sitka spruce, they don't know what would happen to their 170-year operation.
The federal government, they implemented a rule in 2016 that said, hey, you know what? We need to stop harvesting these old growth trees and go to the younger trees. Take us through that briefly.
Yeah. So in 2016, the Forest Service works with the United States Department of Agriculture to create a Tongass Forest Management Plan. Now, that outlines specific timber volumes that they will sell per year. However, what they did was refuse to sell timber. They didn't offer any meaningful timber sales since 2016, definitely not the 46 million board feet that they were supposed to. In fact, over the last 4 or 5 years, it's about 10% of the volume that they were supposed to sell. This has starved the industry. Not only that, the plan, they were supposed to offer that many in timber sales, but also there was a memo issued that said, from Secretary then Vilsack, that said, we're going to stop all large-scale old growth harvest. Now, that put a stop to any sales and any NEPA process, so that we had no supply coming in, and we relied on other land managers to help us out. But the Forest Service was supposed to provide this, and they haven't. So one agency should not be allowed to create or stop an entire industry based on a press release.
Now, along with fellow timber operators and the Alaska Forest Association and free representation by PLF, you're suing the federal government. You spent your entire life watching your dad fight tooth and nail for your family business and the communities that they support. What made this fight so important that you didn't just join your dad, but you've taken on a very amazing and active advocacy role for Alaska's timber industry?
Well, like I said, I was born into this. It's in my blood, I suppose. Timber has given me a lot of opportunities, and I get emotional here talking about it, because I've watched my dad stay up late trying to solve all the issues. It's important to our family. It's important to his employees that he can continue to fight for them, and that he brought me onto this to say, I know you're a fighter too. I know that you're going to carry this through and make sure that our communities are going to have that economic opportunity that they have offered this whole time, those 31 years on Prince of Wales Island. And he wants us to be able to continue that for generations and generations. I have small children who are interested in working in Viking. I want them to have the opportunity to go to Viking Lumber and to operate equipment or to manage that mill someday. I think that is so valuable to say, look what our people, our locals are creating. They're creating the sound in that Steinway piano on stage at Carnegie Hall, played by your favorite performer.
Yeah, and the Ahwahnee Hotel in Yosemite National Park. I was there this summer and saw the Steinway piano in the dining room. It was incredible, and all I could think of was what would happen.
So what would happen?
Yeah, we're so grateful for you taking on this fight, filing the lawsuit in March, and I know since then there have been many moving parts within the administration. And so I guess what we can tell our listeners right now is kind of stay tuned, and we will hopefully have you back for an update. But our time is just about up. Sarah Dahlstrom, it has been such a delight talking with you today. Thank you so much for your courage and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you, Kathy. And thank you, PLF, for fighting the federal government for us.
Absolutely. It's what we do. Well, you can learn more about the case, Alaska Forest Association versus Rollins, and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation to defend individual liberty at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He keeps an eye on events under the Capitol Dome, but also on political developments around the country. And we have had several in the last week or so. We're going to talk about that with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
There was a lot of emphasis put on a special congressional election in Tennessee, Scott. The Democrats thought they had a chance, did they?
Well, let's wind it back a little bit. And you had Congressman Mark Green earlier this summer made the announcement that he was going to resign his seat early, right after they passed the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And that created a special election in Tennessee. We had the primary earlier in October, and Matt Van Epps won that primary in a pretty competitive race, but finished with about 51%. Closest competitor, I think, was in the mid-20s, so about a 25% win. But it's hard to consolidate Republican voters from a competitive primary where there's blood, sweat, and tears in politics, as you want to say. And the Democrats felt like, hey, we can push a lot of money here and make this district, which includes some of Nashville and the suburbs around it and some of the rural areas around it, we can make this a competitive race, even though President Trump won that district by 22% in the 2024 election. And so there was boatloads of money dumped in here for somebody named Afton Bain, and she was a candidate that said she didn't like country music. She didn't like bachelorette parties. She didn't really even like Nashville. And I think that it became sort of a vulnerability for her campaign. Nonetheless, Matt Van Epps, the Republican nominee, was endorsed and supported by President Trump and the Club for Growth PAC. And he pulled out the victory. He won by just under 9%. And it's a big win because there were polling out there that said, oh, this is a 2% race. It's not looking good for early voting. Or can Republicans hang on? Is there going to be a Dem upset? And, you know, this isn't like Connor Lamb in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where you had a really strong middle of the road, almost like a blue dog Democrat. Afton Bain is a lot closer to AOC and the rhetoric that she spews out. And that doesn't resonate with Tennessee and the rural areas or even in Nashville. So Matt Van Epps won that race. And we have to take a look and step back and say, well, why didn't he win by more points? Why didn't he win by 22%? Well, first of all, President Trump was not on the ballot. Trump does bring out different voters in a presidential election than I think we would see in a special election. This is a district that has been competitive in the past. It's turned red, but there's got to be enthusiasm behind Republicans as well. And you're going to see people on social media sort of giving their opinion on what this means electorally for the 2026 midterms. And I think there's one analysis that says, oh, well, you know, if you took 14% away from every Republican and translated this special election nationwide, you'd lose over 40 seats in the House of Representatives. Our majority would be long gone. And, you know, this needs to be a red flashing light, a warning sign for the Republicans to get their act together. I agree that they do need to get their act together and they need to be able to communicate on the victories and accomplishments that President Trump and the Republican Congress and the House and Senate have accomplished. But I do think there's a lot of time to build the narrative for the 2026 midterms and for Republicans to still do well, especially as we wrap up redistricting in the coming months.
It's always dangerous to try and divine the future outcome of elections with elections that are currently or just recently had. As I often say here, Scott, when you've seen one election, you've seen one election because they are all different. Speaking of different, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been a very high-profile member of Congress. She got into a dust-up with President Trump, never really a good idea. She's leaving Congress?
Taylor Greene announced a little bit before Thanksgiving that she was going to hang it up. And this creates a big, bright red open seat in the 14th District of Georgia. I think that Marjorie was sort of a symbol of America First and MAGA when she came in and was a close ally of President Trump. But sometimes you can get a little cross with the president. And I think she decided that, hey, you know, 5 years has been enough. And she'll be retiring from Congress on January 5th or so. And so there's going to be a very, very competitive special election there. I think that you'll look for the governor to set the date very quickly after her resignation is formalized with the clerk of the House. And I think that obviously in Georgia, we can get a very, very solid conservative elected there. We also had a retirement this week out in the Lone Star State in Texas. And there you had Troy Nails, who also has only been in Congress for a couple of terms. He decided to hang it up early. He's going to finish the rest of his term, but he is retiring, and that creates another open seat.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we always end by having you tell us a little bit about the club and where folks can find you on the web.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. If you want to learn about the membership pack that we've got, you can visit clubforgrowth.org. You can also learn about the policies that we advocate for, and you can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for taking time to be here. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The accidental death of Kit Kat the cat has placed the ability of Waymo and other driverless vehicles to continue operating in San Francisco in doubt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Stephen Greenhut of the R Street Institute.
The accidental death of one cat in San Francisco is now triggering calls for banning Waymo and other autonomous vehicles, but that would be a huge mistake, not just for the sake of cats, but for the sake of human beings, too. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Steve Greenhut. He is a resident senior fellow and Western Region Director for State Affairs at the R Street Institute, and he's also a columnist for us at Reason. He joins us to talk about a piece that he wrote this week about Kit Kat the cat in San Francisco. Steve, Kit Kat, unfortunately, is no longer with us, but you are. Thanks for joining us here on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Kit Kat was a bodega cat in San Francisco, was tragically hit and killed by a Waymo on October 27th. But since then, there's just been a whole bunch of outrage, including from some city officials here who are trying to use Kit Kat's tragic death as an excuse to get autonomous cars out of the city.
Yeah, I mean, here, actually, the New York Times reported that Jackie Fielder, the progressive supervisor who represents the Mission District, she introduced a city resolution after Kit Kat's death that calls for the state legislature to let voters decide if driverless cars can operate where they live. So, and then a lot of people have just, like that blog that I read from, and a lot of people are just overheated and upset about it. And as you point out, though, a lot of the people taking advantage of this are the usual suspects, right? The folks who don't like driverless cars anyway, you know, unions that fear job losses, the taxi industry, and progressives, I say, who freak out at every technological innovation, and people who've watched Terminator too many times. Just that coalition that always comes up, the Luddites, right, that always want to stop things, and they usually have, or often have, self-interested motives.
Yeah, and I mean, San Francisco, look, as you put it in the piece, Steve, it's admittedly a quirky place. It's a quirky city, but the emotional debate over the death of Kit Kat the cat is maybe overshadowing the actual value here of autonomous cars.
Like you, I love cats. I'm a total cat nut. I read that like 5.4 4 million cats have been run over in the last year in the country. Presumably 5,399,999 run over by human drivers. So the fact that, you know, one supervisor is pushing for what she wants is local rules to allow localities to restrict or regulate, you know, these self-driving cars. And the state, to its credit, has rejected those rules in a bill like last year, because could you imagine if every city and county had their own rules for driving? It would just shut this technology, shut it down. It would just make it impossible to expand. So the state has been okay about, they just approved expanding it into wine country. And the bottom line is, the life-saving technology. 40 people were killed in car accidents in San Francisco last year or something like that. Well, Waymos are, in any of these self-driving cars, they're way safer than human beings. They don't get drunk. An investigative report by CalMatters that shows that the California DMV continuously lets drunk drivers keep their license, and they kill and sometimes kill again. So Waymos, we don't have to worry about that. So it's sad that they killed Kit Kat, who by all estimation was a very personable bodega cat. But it just, you have to put this in perspective.
Steve, the piece that you wrote for us this week, the headline on that is "Self-Driving Cars Will Make the World Safer for Cats and Humans Too." Crunch the numbers here for me a little bit before we let you go. This is, again, one cat being run over by a Waymo in San Francisco. I don't want to downplay it. That's a bummer. Lots of cats get killed by human drivers every year. And more importantly, lots of people get killed by human drivers every year.
Yeah, there are like 43,000 human deaths from vehicle collisions. And the Swiss Re insurance company, a reinsurance company, and they have, you know, the obvious financial incentive to understand the benefits and risks. They found that the Waymo drivers had 88% reduction in property damage claims and 92% reduction in bodily injury claims. That's significant. And, you know, I like to drive. In fact, when I get off of this, I'm going to get on my motorcycle and take my afternoon jaunt. So in some ways, it's odd to me to not be driving, right? But the fact is that these things are better than human drivers, or safer than human drivers, and letting the technology develop can dramatically potentially reduce deaths, injuries, property damage claims. So we need to let the industry evolve.
Yeah, of course. We rest in peace, Kit Kat, but we shouldn't use that as an opportunity to stop the progress of technology. I'm like you, Steve. I like to drive. I enjoy driving. I don't imagine that I will ever stop driving until I get too old maybe to do it. But I think it's not an either-or proposition here, right? Like, people will still be able to drive, will still have the option to drive. But if you know, in other circumstances, have the opportunity to take a Waymo, well, that's going to be safer. And like you pointed out, Waymos don't get drunk. They don't get lost. A lot of advantages there for people, even people who also enjoy driving sometimes as well. We're unfortunately out of time for today, but good to talk to you, Steve. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for the great piece.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Once again, that is Steve Greenhut from the R Street Institute. Check out their fine work online at rstreet.org. You can also find his column every week at the Orange County Register and at reason.com. His piece this week about how self-driving cars will make the world safer for cats and for humans is available at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A growing number of states are eliminating their personal income taxes, and they are reaping the economic benefits, as we learn from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For all the talk about what government can invest in, one of the most significant economic developments of recent years has been what state governments have chosen not to take, namely income taxes. Since 2021, half the states in the country have enacted reductions to their personal income taxes. Many have gone further, abandoning the old progressive tax structures in favor of simple, low-rate, flat taxes. Kansas and Ohio became the latest states to make that shift earlier this year. A growing number of states have asked a more fundamental question. If income taxes discourage work, investment, and entrepreneurship, why have them at all? Three states have now answered that question by passing laws that will fully eliminate their personal income taxes over time. The income tax has long been treated as a necessary feature of modern government. But necessity is a matter of evidence, not assumption. And the evidence is increasingly difficult to ignore. States without personal income taxes, 9 in total, although Washington State has recently added a capital gains tax of its own, have consistently outperformed many of their high-tax peers. According to our Rich States, Poor States, Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index, 8 of the 9 no-income tax states rank in the top half for economic outlook. This is not coincidence, it's incentive. People go where prospects are better, and the numbers tell a story more compelling than any slogan about shared sacrifice. Tennessee, for example, gained more than 250,000 residents through net domestic in-migration from 2020 to 2024. Texas, also without a personal income tax, gained nearly 750,000 during that period. Florida gained nearly 900,000. And among the remaining no-income tax states, Nevada, New Hampshire, South Dakota, and Wyoming, each saw net in-migration over that same period. When people vote with their feet, there's little ambiguity about which policies encourage opportunity and which stifle it. The states losing residents, the fastest, tend to share another characteristic, that is, steep personal income tax rates. California, despite its wonderful weather, lost more than 1.4 million residents to the other 49 states over the last 4 years. New York, over a million. And even Oregon, once a magnet for newcomers, has become an out-migration state while maintaining the nation's second highest top personal income tax. Incentives matter, and they always have mattered. They don't stop mattering simply because a state government needs revenue either. Given these realities, it should surprise no one that some states are pushing beyond tax cuts and the flat tax conversations and towards that full elimination of the income tax. Kentucky led the way in 2022 by enacting a mechanism to gradually reduce its income tax whenever fiscal conditions met certain benchmarks. This last year, Mississippi and Oklahoma followed suit. These states adopted what we call triggers to reduce the revenues while only when the budgets are healthy and reserves are full and spending is under control. In other words, the process forces the discipline that politicians often promise but seldom deliver. Policymakers are acknowledging that prosperity comes not from redistributing wealth, but from making it easier for wealth to be created in the first place. The predictable criticism is that eliminating income taxes will starve government of revenue needed for essential services. Yet this would imply that the 9 states already operating with such taxes must be suffering some obvious collapse in public services. They are not. Their budgets function sometimes more responsibly than those in high-tax states, precisely because economic vitality expands the tax base in other ways. People earning money, spending money, investing money, and starting businesses ultimately generate more taxable activity than people fleeing punitive tax structures. Americans do not pay taxes because doing so is enjoyable, but because government must perform certain core functions. The real issue is not whether taxes are necessary, but which taxes are justified by the evidence rather than habit. The experience of the no-income tax state shows that a personal income tax is not among the necessities. The movement now underway in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Oklahoma reflects a broader reality in public policy that government growth is not inevitable, that taxpayers' interests need not always rank second to bureaucratic demands, and that states remain, as they have long been, competitive laboratories testing which ideas lead to growth and which lead to decline. In the end, results are what matter, not rhetoric, and the results are pointing in one direction. Freedom works. For more information, you can visit richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXCR-FM in Florence, Oregon, KFMR-FM in Jackson, Wyoming, along with KELO-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.